Second stage is cut. We're now in orbit. Stabilizers up. Running perfect. Starting to collect requested data. What will it affect when all is done? Thinks Major Tom. Back at ground control, there is a problem. Go to rockets full. Not responding. Hello, Major Tom. Are you receiving? Turn the thrusters on. We're standing by. There's no reply.
4, 3.
Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show on the Voice of Vachon, located on beautiful Vachon Island in the heart of the Salish Sea between Seattle and Tacoma in the state of Washington. That was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Brian started the Briefly and brought his high standards of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy. Brian's motto was, less is more, more or less, and he always offered much, much more. Our Briefly panel today includes our big board pilot, real-life pilot, treetop flyer, and almost fully reformed Texan, Truman O'Brien.
I love that last bit. you can't quite take the Texan out of the boy, you know. You can't take the boy out of Texas, though.
No. Well, maybe we should add to that, and Montanan.
That's true. And then I could say, yeah, sure, you betcha.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No.
Also, our legal eagle, consensus builder, former Washington State Assistant Attorney General, ladies' shoe salesman, and Fulbright scholar, Craig Bellis.
Great to be here as usual, Bruce.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Let's see, missing today is our part-time politico, most-time housing wonk, and full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreher. So I don't know how we're going to get into shenanigans without Amy here. So
it's
we got to try hard.
You're the host, Bruce. You're going to have to bring it out.
Yeah, bring out those shenanigans. And also, missing today, somewhere in the wilds of the Broughtons in British Columbia, is our avid defender of justice, mariner, cyclist, and top secret engineer, Kevin Jones. And I'm historian Bruce Holman. Today's small talk guest.
That's not fair. You got to get more than just that. He is the guardian of the galaxy, folks. We're telling you. That's it.
Which is an increasingly difficult job these days.
Indeed.
Yeah. So our small talk guest today is Vashon's celebrated landscape photographer, Terry Donnelly. Good to have you here, Terry.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, we'll get back to you.
Had I known, I would have dressed for this like you guys did. I didn't think for a radio show that people would dress. But,
yeah.
But you guys really pulled out the stops.
We're going to have video for these shows here pretty soon.
Exactly.
And, you know, we may have to up our game a little bit. Because we all have faces made for radio.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And we dress for radio.
I should mention that they're wearing Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah. Well, the weather's right for it, I'll tell you.
Exactly. You only have a few weeks on Vashon when you can wear your Hawaiian shirt, yep. So you got to pull them out and wear
That's
them when
true.
You can. Let's see, before we jump into the talk today, let's take a moment and check in about what special things we've experienced this past week. So, Truman, what's been up with you?
I've had a pretty quiet week. I did get into town yesterday to... had a friend who's in the hospital and went in and paid him a visit, which was kind of fun. And a couple other of his friends were there, and they're all playing guitars in the hospital, which is pretty fun. Quietly, I can tell you it was quietly. But anyway, that's about it, man. I had a real quiet week.
Oh, good, good. Craig, how about you?
Well, my darling wife was up in the mountains on a horse all this last week. Just got home last night. And she went up there with a bunch of women that she got together here from Vashon and went for a packing trip in the Sawtooth. And I was in charge of our multiple animals and horses, and horses qualify as animals, which kept me really busy. Mm-hmm. A lot of shifting and feeding and mixing up stuff, and I really appreciate
and shoveling.
Lots of shoveling, which is difficult in the high grass. But it was good. I love our horses. The other big event was I went to the Coop on Friday. Steve Amston had his not his last show. It's the theme night he has at the Coop where people get up and sign up to sing one song. And this last Friday was... cities and towns, songs that mention cities and towns. And they appropriately started it off with I've Been Everywhere.
I hope they had the lyrics written down for that.
You better believe it. They had the lyrics. It was Chris O'Brien, who was not playing the piano or the keyboards. He was playing his guitar. The man is talented.
Yeah.
So he's playing his guitar and he's got the lyrics there, and you know, and I don't think they were in big enough print. But it was a good night.
Yeah, when Bob's your uncle was playing 10 years ago or so, Paul Caldwell put a version of that together about Vashon. Liza Bueller.
I hope he's still got those lyrics.
I'm sure he does, because it's a kick of a song when Paul does
that. We need to ask him that next time we run into him. That was basically my week. No fixing cars this week, so that was good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the MG is running.
MG is running, yes, indeed. It does need to be tuned up every time I drive it out a mile or two, but then...
Of course. It's a British car.
Yes, it is.
Lucas, the goddess of darkness, right?
Terry,
how about you?
Oh, just let me tell you real quick. I used to have a friend who flew for PSA, and they had the...
They flew MGs?
No, well, almost. No, they flew. I'm trying to think of the name of the airplane now. Anyway, it was a little twin jet, high wing. I can't think of the name of it at the moment. But they always said that the electronics were Lucas electronics. And he said the reason that the British always drink warm beer is all the refrigerators were built by Lucas Electronics. So that kind of gives you some idea of the quality there. Anyway, sorry.
Terry, how was your week?
That was a quiet week. So I'm kind of on the downside of the opening Friday night of the Summerfest show at VCA. Mm-hmm. So having that up on the wall gives me a lot of free time. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking advantage of that.
Oh, good. So my week, again, pretty quiet. Crab season is going on right now. So every Sunday and Monday, we're up early in the morning setting crab pots on Sunday and then pulling Sunday afternoon, early Monday morning, and then Monday afternoon pulling again. I just did a count. You know, we've pulled out 63 big Dungeness crabs in the last four
wow.
weeks. We got 5 weeks to go, so our
what
goal.
What kind of percentage is that? I mean, in terms of the crabs you get, how many do you have to throw back for every onesie?
Well, you can only keep the male Dungeness,
right.
So you got to throw back the females. And I guess we're probably getting maybe 10-20% females. I mean, getting mostly males for Dungeness. For Red Rock, I mean, every pot we pull up, we probably have 4 or 5 Red Rocks to every
right.
Dungeness.
And the Dungeness have a size, too, don't they?
They both do, yeah. Wow. Actually, 6 inches for the Red Rock and 6 1/4 inch for the Dungeness. Mm-hmm. Red Rock, you can keep either gender.
And you're out there with your calibrator, aren't you?
You do. In fact, you legally have to have one on the boat. Yep. There are these little plastic measuring devices yep. you got to mm-hmm. carry. And I got stopped, 2 years ago.
By Fish and Wildlife?
By Fish and Wildlife. We were out, this was in Quartermaster Harbor. And we're out just sort of like, nobody's around. And so we're just pulling the pots. And then out of nowhere, this boat pulls up beside us, Fish and Wildlife. And I got fined $10. because what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to write on your crab card when you pull them up out of the water. Well, I always wait till I get back home and sort them out. And then I fill out my crab. I always fill out my crab card, but I do it. No, you're supposed to do it right there
right
on the
there.
Boat.
Oh, boy.
And we couldn't find our pen. I said, all right, sorry, we got to
well,
cite
you. Obviously met some sort of profile.
Obviously.
They saw you from a distance and they go,
we're going to get this guy out.
$10 crab you got there.
Better than a $100 hamburger.
Not much so.
But overall, this is a good season for
it's pretty good, and they opened it last December, which is really unusual. They haven't opened it in December for years. What's that telling me? And they closed it 2-3 years ago now. They closed it for a year.
Mm.
What's that telling me is essentially the population is coming back pretty strong.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard any response from people who put their crabs out by the mouth of the harbor?
I have not. I talked to one, Ed Davidson put some pots out there the first couple weeks, mm-hmm. and he did okay.
That's on that shelf out there at the end of morning?
Yeah, right, yeah. at mm-hmm. sort of the mouth of the harbor.
There's a shelf out there where the red buoy is.
Yeah, right. typically that's where you see a lot of buoys for crab pots.
Lots of buoys out there, right, yeah.
It drops off pretty darn deep there, though.
Yeah, it goes from 70, 80 feet down to about 250 feet, in a matter of a quarter mile. And actually, that's the old sill for the lake that used to be in the center of Vashon and then became the stream bed for Judd Creek. Originally, Outer Quartermaster Harbor was above water level, until sea levels rose.
Hey, Bruce goes way back. He remembers.
Right.
He looks old, but well, not that old.
You said he was a historian. You didn't realize, did you?
Yeah. The other thing I did this weekend that was a kick was the Big Sky for the Land Trust on Saturday night. And it was just a beautiful evening, sort of a great gathering. And And at the end, they do this pie contest kind of thing. You get your table number drawn, and you go get pies.
Oh, yeah,
and stuff.
Of course.
So you got to get everybody prepped at the table, and who's going to pick the pie, and who's going to get the plates, and all that
sort
of stuff.
That has really turned into a huge event.
It's incredible. Yeah. It's an amazing event, and they do a really good job of it. So that was fun, and Terry was there. You were there.
Oh, it was great, yeah. So you good music, the, nice dancing good, afterwards.
Yeah, dancing afterwards. It was a great
probably
evening.
Raised a buck or two. For the land
trust?
Yeah,
they interesting. Last year, they did this thing where they raised funds. They wanted commitments for a five-year sort of commitment. Right. And I think they raised $2.3 million over the next 5 years.
Whoa.
You know,
that's a little
like
different
that.
Than when I was on the first land trust board.
Yeah.
That's a while back, right?
With them on. The,
Yeah, a while back. Oh, but but this year, because they've got so many people have made these five-year commitments. They didn't do that kind of thing again. They certainly had a suggestion, and they had things on the table where you could make donations. But again, I think a lot of people are just extending their donations or adding to them, that kind of thing. But
we have a thing like that on for the Voice of Vashon, mm-hmm. where we try to get three-year commitments and whatnot. Yep. Occasionally, we have problems with our credit card company, and we decided we'd come up with a new category, Infinity and Beyond.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, exactly. We don't have anybody who's signed up for that.
Not yet.
No. We're hopeful. Ever hopeful.
Right. Ever hopeful. Yeah. So today, July 28th, significant day. It's National According to Hoyle Day.
Where did you that? Is that the card game? I mean the rules for playing cards.
For Hoyle's rule of cards. Yeah,
yeah all yeah. kinds.
It's
of
according
games.
To Hoyle.
According
that's
to
illegal
Hoyle.
Verse.
Yep. Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's sort of the
not Marcus of Queensbury. That's a different sort
yeah,
of
yeah. Yeah. Right. It's close.
Similar. Similar.
It can be. It can be quite similar.
The Hoyle rules often devolve into the Queensbury rules.
Exactly.
Right? Depending on the poker game.
Exactly.
It's also National Lemon Day. And I don't know if that refers to the fruit or the cars.
Or the cars.
Right? Sort of like, or both.
Or
right?
both, yeah.
And then it's International Day Against Nuclear Tests. And I think that's a relatively recent UN initiative, but I think it's based on the fact that in 1949, the Soviet Union tested their first atomic bomb, which the Americans named Joe 1, after Joe Stalin, of course.
I'm sorry, what was the year again?
1949.
Okay.
So other significant dates. This is the day that the Spanish Armada was defeated in 1588. It's also the day that the Tonight Show with Jack Parr began the sort of modern evening talk show format.
Point of clarification.
Yes.
I have to take issue with you on that one.
Okay.
The modern Tonight Show format was started by Steve Allen in 1954.
That's true. Yeah.
1954 to 1957. Yep. Steve Allen deserves his due.
He does.
Right. He really did start it, and it was groundbreaking and hilarious.
Yes.
And I feel a special connection to him because I took a class from him at the University of California at Santa Barbara on creativity.
Really?
And the man was a genius,
right. Yeah.
And a fabulous musician.
You're right. Darn. So Tonight Show in 1957, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, and Johnny followed him, right? I mean, was he the was
yeah,
he?
Yeah, Johnny Carson followed Jack Parr.
Yeah, right.
Ernie Kovacs was kind of shoehorned right in there before Jack Parr.
Right.
That was only part time.
And then 1981, Prince Charles and Princess Diana were wed. And in 2005, Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. So, significant day.
Yeah.
So let's shift into our small talk and talk with Terry Donnelly a bit and learn about the life of a professional photographer on Vashon Island.
It's quite glamorous.
the glamorous, exciting life of a professional photographer. So, Terry, tell us a bit about yourself, your background, how you ended up on Vashon, and how you ended up becoming a professional photographer.
That's a lot. This is an hour program, right?
That's right. I was born in...
Yeah, don't start where Craig usually does.
No. Mary Liz and I moved out here. We got to Vashon in 94 after house sharing in Seattle while Mary was going to school. Mm-hmm. And so we found, oddly enough, an affordable house on Vashon, remodeled it, moved in, and... So that was also very early in our career as photographers. So we were gone quite a bit, and it took quite a while before we really got our feet into the community of Vashon because we were gone all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you were gone.
We were gone for photography, and what we did was we did nature and landscape photography. And we marketed our work to publishers mostly. And the publishers we dealt with were, it could be summed up as paper products publishers. There were calendars, cards, books, travel magazines. So there was, in those days, in the 90s, it's pre-digital. And so there people had a voracious appetite for photographs. And they had to go to photographers to get them. So... we filled that need. And it also required us to have a fresh collection of work to show people, you know, that at the end of the year. So
where are some of the places you would travel?
We base our travels not so much on location, but more on subject matter. And the subject matter that held our attention were topics that... that resonated with people. For instance, places that we would seek out were Caribbean islands with the best beaches. So you photograph beaches. You'd travel across the U.S. looking for lighthouses. So it was very much subject oriented, and that's we are feeding a market that uses those images. Mm-hmm. So national parks, anything that says Americana after 9/11. Any picture with an American flag in it was very popular. Mm. So, and we would spend typically a year, we would be on the road 90 to 100 days. So we were gone quite a bit.
So I know that there's the writer's market, which is a book that, you know, has there's a photographer's market as well, right? Did you tend to use something like that as a reference? Or?
No, not really. I think if people looking for a photographer, you would find that. But what we dealt with was we dealt directly with publishers.
Okay.
And so the way we sought clients was to wander through a bookstore and pick out magazines or books, travel publications that used the style of photography that we did.
Ah, okay.
So... and then you'd make a note of on the masthead of the magazine of who the art director or the photo editor was, and you'd give them a phone call. Oh. That was a time when people actually answered.
I was going to say, calls. Wow, that's pretty incredible. Yeah.
So let me follow up a little bit with that. You and Mary have both won numerous awards. You've been on Sierra. Club calendars.
Yes, Sierra Club
books
calendars. That was always the kind of the benchmark of the calendar world because they started it very early, and that was a thing to be published by Sierra Club, and still is. They're still a very high profile.
So tell us a little bit, I mean, how has the world of a professional photographer changed since those early 90s, pre-digital, to today, you know, digital, internet, you know, sort of TikToks?
Yeah, you know, it's crazily different because not only do you have the market and the whole environment for publishing changed after 2008, And so that really pulled back on the need for photographs, because after that economic setback, publishers didn't have the budgets that they used to have, so they didn't hire photographers to go out and take pictures of streams for Trout Unlimited, mm-hmm. for example. So they would start to turn more to photo stock agencies, and then when they just got bigger and bigger, and the small guy kind of got squeezed out. Mm-hmm. But typically for photographers, the market just isn't there anymore the way it used to be. Mm-hmm. So I think if you are a photographer doing community pictures like weddings, senior portraits, or just plain old portraits photography, you're working in a very small environment and you're working in a small community. But to go out and get that collection of big images that there was a waiting market for, that just doesn't exist. And what happens is the people would now typically go to Getty. And
I was just going to ask if Getty was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. that's very big. Mm-hmm. So
when did you move into having your own website? I mean, it was
as soon as we could. Yeah, that was a brand new thing when the internet came about, and it made it easy. So, but before that, what we would typically do is you had a list of clients, and you knew what their photo needs were and what their schedules were. So what your job was to do is to stay in communication with that, say, the photo editor, and make sure that you had your fresh film in front of them when they were making the decisions of putting their product together. So calendars typically do that on a yearly cycle, naturally, mm-hmm. and they're usually 2 to 3 years ahead mm. of the present day. So right now people are putting 2027 and 2028 calendars together. So the trick in those days, before websites, was to pull your new photographs together and put a package together and send them off so that you're in front of them when they mm. put their products together. But then as soon as you could put a website together, they have access to all of your pictures. So that made it quite a bit simpler.
You know, several years ago, my wife and I published an article it's Private Pilot magazine, I think is mm-hmm. what it was. And we first sent it to Flying magazine, which was a huge, you know, and they wrote back right away and said, boy, we're really sorry. We would have taken your article, but we're just having an article coming out on the same subject. Yeah. That same month.
Timing is everything.
Yeah, I was going to say. So that's got to be a huge part of the process is the timing.
Right. Mm. So we had, and then still have, strong relationships with certain publishers, and they know what we do. Right. We know what they need, and our job is to make that transition easy. So it's actually it's a sales project is what it is.
Yeah.
Knowing your market.
I actually have a couple of unrelated questions, but one is, I think we skipped over something.
Uh-oh.
How do you get to be a photographer? Well, you go up, run out and spend a fortune on a Hasselblad and start clicking away? Or
you suspend your concept of reason.
yeah.
You're gonna
in your bank account, right?
Yeah. When Mary and I started this, I had a lot of friends. They say you're going to move to Seattle and you're going to take pictures. They're just incredible. It's like, what's your job though? What are you going to do? Yeah. So, but how do you do it? The way I started was I always did photography, mostly black and white. Always had a dark room, and it was kind of a hobby. And I found out that if I photographed in color, people would pay for it. Mm. And so, living in the Midwest, my very first clients were agricultural publications like the Illinois Prairie Farmer and the Wisconsin Agriculturalist. And they were very small publications, not a great circulation, but they always had a cover picture in color. And it's usually a barn or a farm scene, which I was surrounded by living in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And so I dealt with those guys. And after that, it kind of morphed into spreading out. I found a stock agency in Chicago. And I sent them a submission. They sent me a contract. And it was kind of off to the races after that. Mm. And as long as you have somebody like a stock agency representing your work, you could feed them as much as you wanted. And the more you fed them, if it was appropriate, the more successful you were.
In the days of film, how would you submit your stuff?
FedEx.
Would you?
Our FedEx bills were huge in those days. Yeah,
but would you send them negatives or would you send them prints?
No, what we did.
Or slides?
And one of the things that distinguished the photography that Mary Liz and I did was that we shot 4x5 film. So we weren't going around with 35 millimeter cameras collecting pictures.
Were you speed graphic or what were you using?
There were wooden field cameras. It's the usual, you know, focusing cloth kind of old style sort of thing. And they're still out there. But publishers in those days, also for high-end publications, they wanted large pieces of film rather than a 35 millimeter slide. We were shooting the same film, but on 4x5 inches.
Wow.
And so the resolution on that was just absolutely, so it gave us an edge, a huge edge there. So it just grew after that. And Mary Liz didn't start shooting until she had finished. We came out because she got her master's degree in nutrition at Bastyr University. Mm-hmm. So that qualified her as a photographer.
I was just going to say, that fits.
Where did you where did you learn composition?
School of Art and Knox. I look at, I've still got all my old negatives from way back when, and I look at them to clean house, straighten things up. And I think, why did this person persist? These are really bad.
Yeah.
So you learned on the street.
Pretty much. Yeah, I did a couple of workshops. There were some really good workshops that happened. There was one in Vermont, Fred Picker. And you knew these people through magazines and publications that they did. And those are very helpful because you would sit down with and spend a week with other photographers like yourself, and you would learn not so much from what the presenter is giving you, but from the other people around you.
Sure.
And so workshops are good.
Yeah.
There was also a very curious community of competitors and colleagues who were doing the exact same thing. We were all working with the same publishers, and we knew each other because when you were in a book or a magazine, the first thing you do is look for the photo credits and see who else is doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get to know those people because you'd bump into them in the field, so you'd know their reputation. And eventually, over the years, you would meet up with them and you became friends. So then people start calling around, and if you have a friend in Tucson, you start calling them in December, January, asking what the weather's like and is there going to be a good bloom this year. And they're asking me what the weather is like here, and are the waterfalls overflowing, or are they looking good? So it was an interesting case of having these relationships with people who are your direct competitors, but also friends. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting.
You know, you were asking about how you learned. Two things. My brother studied photography when he was in the military, and one of his teachers said there are three rules for being a great photographer or learning to be a great photographer, and they are shoot, shoot, and shoot.
That's right. Yeah.
And that makes sense. But what I was going to say is, my daughter is a photographer as well. I mean, she went to school for it and all. But one of the things that we found, we took a trip to Europe when she was pretty young, maybe sophomore, junior in high school. And I had a very nice camera. I do a lot of photography, and I bought her a fairly inexpensive point and shoot.
Mm-hmm.
We got back from Europe, and I had my film processed. I have a Hasselblad, and I had my film processed and had hers, and I compared photographs, and I went, your photographs with that little point and shoot are way better than mine. And the reason was composition.
Oh, yeah.
It's all in the eye. So you don't learn that. That is something that's innate.
No, it's a learned thing.
It's something I think that's innate to start with, and then you can develop it. But I think being able to see that composition is
You can develop it. No pun intended.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I think you can learn to do well composing photographs. But I think the main thing isn't, it's not about the equipment or the camera. Mm-mm. It's really about paying attention.
Yeah. My favorite story along those lines, we were in San Diego, and they have the sailing ship. I can't think of the name of it at the moment. But anyway, it was sitting there in full sail at the dock. And I took a photograph. I had a little point and shoot. And Molly didn't have a camera at that point. Or she did, but she didn't have it with her. And she said, Dad, can I borrow your camera? And I said, sure. I handed her the camera. And she took two steps to the right or whatever. And she took photographs.
Yeah.
And we look at my photograph. And you look at her photograph, and hers is spectacular, and mine is kind of,
Yeah.
It's that.
No, she had a sense for what's right.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. It's all in knowing where to put your tripod.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yep.
You know, you mentioned at the beginning about the VCA Summerfest show. You have an artist statement at the current show, and it says, I am an island photographer with an extensive background in landscape and travel photography. And you've told us somewhat about your traveling around, doing landscape and travel photography. I'm one of the things I'm curious about is you said you moved from black and white photography to color photography in order to make more of a living.
Right.
But today you do both.
No, I still love black and white.
And how do you determine? why do you decide this should be in black and white and this should be in color?
Well, it speaks to you. It tells you. The photograph tells you. It's not up to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I see it one way or the other. Some people will say, "Well, that works well either way," and it's like I don't. That's not it. Even when I'm photographing, I have it in mind of whether it's going to be black and white or color.
And do you choose at that moment, or do you?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, and there's some interesting discussions going on, you know, in different photo websites about whether or not it makes a difference that you're with digital cameras now. You take a picture, and you can make it black and white or whatever you want. But in the old days, you had film, and you were committed to one or the other.
Tri-X or Kodachrome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so people are saying, so can you really consistently do black and white photography if you're not distracted by having the ability to shoot this in color? It's like, well, yeah. You know, you just make that commitment that I'm doing black and white.
So do you set your... Do you set your camera for black and white? Your digital camera?
No, I don't.
You do everything.
When I'm in the field, I'm looking at color.
But in your head.
Yeah, I'm looking at color.
Yeah, right.
But you're.
But my brain is thinking. I know already how it's going to get processed.
Well,
in the show at VCA, it's a mix of black and white and color, and I would say that's an obvious example of why some pictures are black and white. Some of those pictures are screaming in color. Some have very subtle colors. And then the black and whites, if you saw those in off of the camera before I converted it to black and white, you would see why they're black and white. There's no color in the picture. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of looking at shapes and forms and the light
value.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I know the whites are going to pop in this picture, and it doesn't matter if they're a lime green or orange or what, but it's just you know how it's going to respond to black and white. And black and white is so much easier. I mean, I'm married. I would be much easier to live with if I didn't shoot color. you could ask Mary Liz about that. She'll tell you.
So in that artist statement, you continue, in recent years, my attention has been focused on people and places closer to home as I seek to reveal the sense of truth and beauty in the seemingly ordinary subjects I'm closest to. That fascinates me because it gets back to that having that eye, that artist eye. And what inspires you, I guess, is the question. Or is there any particular thing?
Generally, what what inspires me to photograph. It's making photographs is, for me, it's a reaction, and it's a reaction to this thought that happens when you see something that is significant to you for whatever reason. You want to say to the person next to you, "Hey, look at that!"
Ah.
And so that's what photography is for me. It's capturing something that I resonate with, whatever it could be, and I just want to show people, this is what I saw. This is.
I love that. Hey, look at this.
Yeah, right.
I got to remember that. That is excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So, and that still happens, and so I think, well, you know, as you kind of age, you think, is it time for me to give up photography? But then I'm sitting in a Snapdragon having coffee last Friday morning, and these people stand up. They were from off island, and they all lined up in front of the table that we were sitting at to have their picture taken as a group. So there were six people facing away from our table, but they all put their arms around each other. Mm-hmm. And so right in front of us was this line of people and all these arms and hands holding onto each other. And I thought, geez, where's my camera? So I know it's not time for me to quit yet. I'm still,
exactly.
I'm still seeing this stuff, and I still want to say, hey, look at
that. Look at that. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That is.
Craig?
I want to focus back on Summerfest at VCA. I mean, do you occupy the atrium out there?
No, the way Summerfest works is it's kind of like it's not exhibit light, but what they did is they have three exhibits that they put on, and each one, instead of lasting a month, which they usually do through the year, these go for about 2.5 weeks. And there are three rotations, and each rotation has maybe 10-15 people in it. And when you submit an application to participate, they ask for a set of pictures that are thematically related, and then you also get to request how much space you want to make this presentation, which is an unheard of thing. You know, usually you make you apply, and they will say you're either in or you're out, and they will say you've got so much space. But this, they leave it fairly open. And so Lynn Ann, who puts it all together, when she gets these applications in, she juggles people, scheduling them, and also assigning space, and she does a brilliant job. I mean, the show that I'm in is really quite fascinating, because she's got I'm in the square gallery part, not in the atrium. And on one wall she has Ilse Remnitz and you know, her print work. Mm-hmm. And adjacent to her is Diane Grobe, and they both do related artwork, but they're very different. Ilse's are very large prints that she makes, and Diane's are rather small. Hers are probably 9x12, I guess. And Diane's are eco prints, and they just resonate so well with Ilse's work. And then, so I'm a photographer on the other side of the room, and next to me is Brooke. And Brooke has a set of images that are cyanotypes, which are it's like a photograph. It's a light based image making, which is, you know, very blue. So it really connects with photography well. So anyway, that's what the Summerfest is. It's three rotations of art like that, but it's a quick show. It only lasts 2.5 weeks. Mm.
So you got to get in there and see it if you're going to.
So you got to get in there.
So when did it go up?
So this went up last Friday, and it goes through the 10th of August.
Okay,
and then the next one starts on August 15th, and that goes through the end of the month, and then into September they go into the normal schedule again. Mm-hmm. So they just pack in summer three quick shows, and it increases their workload by 30%, because they're doing three shows in 2 month time. So. Yeah,
so first Friday off would be a good time to go in there and take.
Yeah,
off.
First Friday will be another kind of an opening reception kind of thing.
Right.
So yeah, hats off to Lynn Ann for doing all the extra work to do this in the summer.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say, you mentioned that the gallery or whatever has a theme for that.
Right.
When you go out and shoot, do you shoot based on a theme sometimes?
Oh, yeah. No, so and that goes on for years. Right. So I've got things that I'm attracted to, uh-huh. and maybe I'll pick up two or three pictures a year. But over time...
but it's based on that.
Yeah, it's good.
It's not like sales, for example.
Exactly.
So you want to see
anything
that has a sale in it, you're interested. Okay.
Kind of, yeah. One thing is abandoned pilings, of which we have a lot mm-hmm. around here. Mm-hmm. And historic things fascinate me because there's a narrative involved in it. And so it's seeing those things, you wonder...
What happened
to them? Why are they gone? Why are they there in the first place? What's the scoop? What's the story with them? And I'm reacting to it as a photographer because of its graphic appeal. They're great graphic
visual
elements. Elements to deal with compositionally. Mm. But there's also a historic element to it also. And that's what fascinates me.
Mm. Well, just to follow up on that, the introduction to your exhibit also states that your collection of photographs from Mukai Pond exemplifies your pursuit of seeking the quiet beauty within ordinary subject matter. So I assume that many, if not all, of the photographs there are of Mukai?
Yeah, well, that was my theme, is Mukai Pond.
Okay.
So I've got 14 images up. Four of them are color. I mean, four of them are black and white. The rest are color.
And what attracts you to Mukai?
I don't know. It's local. It's what we have. Is it a beautiful place? It can be.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce and I walk there fairly often, mm-hmm. and it's photographing it is different from visiting the place.
Mm.
So typically, if Bruce and I are going to go for a walk, we have a set time in the morning. But if I'm going to photograph, I'm not going to do it on a day like today. I'll wait for some special conditions, whatever that means,
mm-hmm.
Where I know it's going to be showing me something mm-hmm. that is not typical, your typical day.
Oh,
so that can be early April, just when the hardwood, when the alders and this just start to open up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful thing that lasts a day or 2 days before the leaves really pop mm-hmm. open. And the colors deepen, it all changes. So you're aware of, you know, little narrow opportunities to shoot and get something. Same with December. Actually, December is a beautiful time to be there because there's still color left in the red twig dogwoods. And, it's just, it's a beautiful spot.
You get the mist rising off the water.
If you're lucky to get there
exactly.
to see that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Have you learned anything in your career from taking a picture of the same subject over the years, over and over again?
Oh yeah, I think that's a vital thing to do. I think that's how I basically learned photography, is where I grew up and lived until I was 35. There was a state park near where I lived. It was 15 minutes away. And so I would just make a practice of, on my day off or weekends, I would just go hike the same trails and photograph. And it's not that I got that many pictures out of it, but over time I could, it was like a benchmark that I could measure any progress as a photographer mm-hmm. that I was making.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, I think it's a really good idea for photographers to have projects like that or certain subjects that you keep going back to over and over and over again, and so that you're not only watching this place change over time, but you're also watching yourself change.
Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of, it's
interesting. I'm no professional photographer, but I just happen to have a wonderful view of the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And last night with the smoke... last evening with the smoke coming out and turning the sky brilliant orange and red. It's just fascinating that the scene there does change constantly.
Oh, yeah. No,
or the
moon
setting there in the morning or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, there's a saying among photographers that if you show up someplace to get a certain scene and for some reason you miss what's happening, it's like there's no going back. Mm-hmm. This isn't going to happen again. This is a one-time deal.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just a matter of seconds.
Oh, yeah.
You have that opportunity.
Yeah.
So I have two questions. The first is, what other places on Vashon have you spent some time photographing, and are there any special places other than Mukai that
I've got? Yeah, there's a few places that I have that I keep going back to when the conditions are right, whatever that means. And they're on private property, so I'm not going to tell you where they are, or I'll lose my happy home. Yeah. But there are, you know, the beaches here are tremendous, and so one of my things is to keep going back to the pilings. And it's not that, you know, the pilings don't change much except for the tide level.
or the bird that's sitting on it.
Yeah, or the birds, yeah. But the conditions around it is what really makes the picture. Right. Yeah, it's really the conditions.
So, you know, I know that today, because of cell phones, and that there are more photographs being taken today than ever in history, all around the world. And how has that influx of that, you know, rash of photographs, has that affected your process or your what you do at all?
I'm sure it has, but I'm not sure how. I think we're flooded with images all over the place.
All over. And the digital, the other question is really about the digital. Did it take you some time to go from film to digital?
Oh, yes, it did.
Yeah. My daughter was the same way. She refused it for a long time.
Yeah, it did. And, well, and in fact, my wife, Mary Liz Austin, she's disillusioned with photography in general, because what she loved is the whole process of using that 4x5 camera. It slowed you down. Mm-hmm. You didn't take a picture in 5 minutes. It took you 5 minutes to set up, so you had to be ready. And it's just this very involved process. It's somewhat technically oriented, but in an analog sense and not in a digital sense.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're looking under a dark cloth at an image on a ground glass that's upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you compose. And that's mm-hmm. and there's a magic to that just doesn't exist with digital cameras. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting thing that's happening with digital cameras these days, is that with the younger generations, there's a resurgence of shooting film.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
mm-hmm.
because of the look and because of the commitment that you need to make.
Mm-hmm.
But also in the equipment, there are new lens makers out there making lenses for small digital cameras, which are like the old-time preset lenses that you have to focus by hand.
Mm-hmm.
You have to open the diaphragm manually to focus, and then stop it down to f8 or f16, whatever your choice is. And you have to, and
resolution.
So people are looking for that ability, instead of having autofocus and a mm-hmm. camera that recognizes that you're taking a picture of a dog and it focuses on the left eye of the dog. It's like, this is overkill. We don't need this.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, I think it's kind of like people wanting to get into a sports car and drive it and actually use a gear shift. It's like, I want to be involved in
the process.
Yeah, so that's happening somewhere I keep talking
about my daughter, but she's gotten into photographing portraits of horses.
Mm-hmm.
And the light and the reflectors and all of the stuff that she uses to get the light to be bright, that whole process is fascinating for her. And
mm-hmm.
She grew up in the autofocus world, you know, in the auto exposure and all of that. So it took her some time to learn how to focus and how to, you know, to do the f-stop to get the right depth of field and all of those things. And so I think she's being fascinated with that process now.
Yeah,
exactly
yeah.
what you're saying.
Yeah,
so.
And the manufacturers are just trying to make it easier for you, but then you're stopped in the middle of the field, and if you hit the wrong button, you've got to go back into the menu of your camera and figure out exactly
how to turn all that stuff off.
No thanks.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, Gary, you and I started working together on a series for the Beachcomber called Time and Again in 2009. That's 16 years ago.
That's
amazing. Yeah. So, you know, we've done, 130 of those articles over the last 16 years or so. What, in that process, what have you learned about Vashon. What have you learned about yourself, and have you come to see Vashon differently?
That's a great question.
Yeah, I know.
A simple one, too, isn't it? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We have
yes.
another.
Yes, I have.
We have another 7 or 8 minutes. Okay. So take your time.
Okay. Okay, as far as seeing things differently, I don't think they caused me to see anything differently, whether working with you and learning the history of things that I see, but it certainly makes it, it makes my experience much richer, and I have a deeper understanding of things. And so I don't think it's really changed things, but it certainly has enriched it. And I think that's the nice thing about that article that you write. Mm-hmm. And people are very interested to know more about the place that they live and what happened before they got here and how it got this way. Yeah. And and so I think that's, yeah.
I can't imagine that would affect your photography, though, wouldn't it? I mean, because you're looking at something going, what did that look like before, and how can I capture that change?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, in landscape photography, that's not so much the case, because when you're mm-hmm. out in nature,
it's a different thing.
But when you're photographing people, you're doing portraits of people, or you're doing historic things like what Bruce and I do. You start involving people, you start involving culture, and now the next thing you know, you've got a narrative going here.
Yeah,
it's like
exactly.
The pilings. It's like, why were these here? So it starts to raise questions. When you see a picture of the Smoky Mountains, you say, well, that's a beautiful scene, but that's the end of it, unless you're maybe a geologist or a forester or something. But when you start looking at things and learning the history of them in the place that you live, it just really enriches it.
Yeah,
yeah. Wow. So, and that's, yeah, the thing that I've morphed into lately after when that roastery book started in 2016, which was the advent of digital. It allowed me, instead of setting up a big camera to photograph, I could take a little point and shoot and sit in the roastery and photograph some of those guys who are the roastery regulars, mm-hmm. whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot less obtrusive. So it does open doors. I don't want to, you know, complain about digital all the time, but...
So you have moved into portraits.
I do. So, yeah, and again, for the same reason, because it allows you to get to know a person by sitting next to them mm-hmm. and spending time one-on-one.
Not just their rear ends that are...
well, that was, yeah, that was... That example was a little bit, a little unusual. Yeah.
No, I love that, though. I think that is, it's that eye. That's the thing that I keep talking about. Is you just need to have that vision to see that photograph.
Yeah, and I think it's just a matter of paying attention. It's just awareness of what's going on.
Yeah. But again, it takes an eye to do that composition. You just absolutely, I don't know how to explain it any other way. It's just there.
For me, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I think partly for me and working with you, I mean, when we started this 16 years ago, I mean, we sort of based it off of the Paul Doerr plot, Seattle Times, then and now, he'd take a historic photograph and then go back and recreate it, and we did that initially for a few times, and it's sort of like, I just felt like it didn't work for you in terms of, you're not there to recreate a photograph, but you're there to capture what it is now.
Right.
And so it shifts that whole sort of emphasis.
Trying to recreate a photograph. Oh, well, I just remember in the first years how difficult it was that we would find this great old-time photo of whatever part of the island, and we'd go back and we'd find the location and we'd see a wall of trees.
Oh, yeah.
That happened so many times. So then you step back and say, well, how are we going to deal with this? We've got to somehow compensate either in the article or the photos that we're using. So... Mm-hmm.
I have an island friend who's an artist, and she says, I hate trees. Trees are they cover up everything. You don't get to see anything because of the darn trees, which I think is very funny. But but I can see it.
Especially
does.
If you live here.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh.
So So what other kind of projects? I mean, you did the coffee roastery book. You know, what other kinds of projects are you involved
with? Back of my mind, one of the things that I've done is in our travels, we would stop in ghost towns. And for the same reason of the historic narrative that comes up, by photographing ghost towns, I found it attractive. Mm-hmm. So now I'm thinking I wouldn't mind going up into northern Montana and North Dakota, looking at some of the ghost towns up in that part of the country in the prairie.
There's some phenomenal places, especially the Big Sky Country up at the High Line up there.
Between Glasgow and North Point. The place I'm talking about.
Fantastic. Yep. We always talk about looking at a barn saying that a hoogag leaned against it. And I'm trying to remember now the writer who came up with that, but... You can see a barn that's leaning, and you go, okay, yeah, Hoogag's been leaning against that one, you know. Yeah.
So, Terry, so remind us about Summerfest and how much longer are your Mukai photos going to be up?
Summerfest round two goes to August 10th, and then the next one starts on August 15th. So there's a gap in there. And then there's a whole different, another 12 artists that bring their work into VCA for 2.5 weeks.
So if our listeners are interested in seeing more of your and Mary Liz's photographs, do you have a website?
We do.
How do they get to it?
It's easy. It's donnelly-austin.com. Check it out. And it's got some, there's a nice collection of people, pictures of, you know, Vashon people at work. So,
and in fact, I'm looking at your website as we speak, and I noticed, though, it says donnelly-austin.photoshelter.com.
Photo shelter is the host that holds the website.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So, but it's just donnelly-austin.com. Okay.
Right.
Phenomenal. By the way, this is a beautiful website.
Thanks,
Truman. I have to tell you.
Yeah, it is well worth a visit, and it's broken down by states and by areas and by Vashon.
The main section is largely devoted to location, but then there's also a people section too.
Great.
We got 30.
So Craig, what's coming up next week?
Well, real quickly, because I think we only got a couple of seconds left. Mark Sayre and Richard Hazard of the Vashon Film Institute. They're going to be talking about the Vashon Film Festival, which is going to be next week. So we'll catch them just before the film festival starts. They'll tell us all about the great films they're going to have.
Great.
So for Truman, Craig, Terry, I'm Bruce Hallman. Thanks for spending the hour with us, and thanks for listening to KVSH 101.9 FM, the Voice of Vashon, also streaming live at voiceofvashon.org.
Take an advantage of the people.